Friday, January 15th, I asked Simone to go into Johnson City with a lace placemat from the Philippines to go under the Roosevelt China White House setting as part of our little display for state dinner, from the invitation to the picture of the chief of state with the president and his wife. In this case, it was of the Macapagals from the Philippines, and fittingly enough, the placemat was from the Philippines. And then I had a 2-hour session with Mr. Roy Rodman, the chief landscape designer of DeWitt Greer's Highway Department. He's the papacita and most knowledgeable man about what Texas has done to plant native shrubs along the highways, and also the carpet of wildflowers that appears from March through June if it rains. The program was begun about 1933 by Jacques Goebbels, whose assistant Rodman was. So for more than 30 years, they've carried it forward, making Texas one of the most progressive states for beautification of highways. Their philosophy is only native things that once planted on the right-of-way and given minimum care until they establish themselves, that is, 1 to 2 years, can then be left alone and never tended again. In East Texas, that's dogwood and redbud and wisteria. There are 20 miles of wisteria on Highway 80 west of Marshall. In our own central Texas, where the East Texas crepe myrtle begins to play out or grow smaller, there's Senesa and Retama and Mountain Laurel. And going on down toward the border, you come into the Wasatch Country and the Palm Country. In West Texas and the Panhandle, they must be hard put to it. They rely on the century plant, Spanish dagger, all sort of varieties of yucca. And then for fall color in much of the state, the sumac. But the wildflower program is the really unusual one. 32 years ago, they began sprinkling along the highways about 20 of the commoner Texas wildflowers. We have 500 varieties in Texas. Bluebonnets head the list because they're showy in mass and the Texas state flower. But Indian paintbrush and Indian blanket, Gallardia. Wild phlox, wild verbena, wine cups, varieties of thistle and poppy. Take the right-of-ways of Texas, a glorious sight for 3 or 4 months when it rains. They deliberately do not try to have late summer or fall flowers, because by about June, and by then the spring flowers, have formed their seed pods and can be mowed. They have to cut down the growth for safety's sake. So when they mow it, that would put an end to things that were going to bloom in the fall, except for those that are inaccessible or rocky places along the right-of-way and are there by God's chance and not the highways department's. I'm deliberately exposing myself to learning about what our state and others have done about beautification in case I become involved in Lyndon's program, because I've got to be somewhat knowledgeable if I do. We were among the first states to take advantage of the federal government's highway bill, which made a portion of the money it allotted to states for highway use tagged for landscape work. I rushed back from the birthplace just in time to meet Secretary Rusk Plain. He was bringing with him Mac George Bundy and Mary, always my favorite house guests, and Mr. Paul Martin, his opposite number, Secretary of State for Canada. A few minutes behind them, with well-planned precision, arrived beaming, Florida-tanned Prime Minister Pearson and Mrs. Pearson, with the briefest, most informal remarks of greeting out by airplane hangar to the gathered newspaper men. And then we got in the helicopter without even giving the ladies time to get into flat-heeled shoes. Flew to the West Ranch, and I took Mrs. Pearson and her secretary and Mary Bundy, and the four of us rode until twilight, seeing at close hand 3 armadillos, which fascinated Mrs. Pearson, and herds of deer grazing in the valley, a ballet of deer jumping the stone fences, and the beautiful outline of the hills against the twilight. Over the talking machine, I heard Lyndon ask John and Nellie to come for dinner. The ladies drove home in time to change. And about 7:30, we were all gathered in the living room for a delightful 2 hours. The talk, of course, centered pretty much on Churchill, who has lapsed into a coma and there is no hope for him. Everybody reminisced about how his life had touched theirs. We talked about how anybody could use words eloquent enough to express what he had meant to the 20th century, when on his death it becomes necessary to make such a statement. And Mr. Pearson pretty well summed it up when he said only Churchill himself would be equal to the occasion. Mr. Pearson is quite a raconteur himself. He told about a gathering in Canada between a delegation of Russians, among them Gromyko, at a particularly tense time when there'd been a spy episode and very strained feelings, and of the following conversation. Gromyko, apparently wanting to stay on a bland and safe subject, inquired, "Do you raise apples in Canada?" "Yes," said General MacNaughton, the Canadian opposite number. "What are your best brands?" said Gromyko. Without hesitation and with honesty, General MacNaughton replied, "Our best brands are Northern Spies and Macintosh Reds." You never hear what happens next after these punchlines in stories that good. And then he told a story about how Leland Stanford, the famous philanthropist, was visiting President Eliot of Harvard University. And he said, "How much would it cost today to build Harvard?" President Eliot said, "I wonder if it could be with a ponderous assurance that it could never possibly be done. It would take $100 million today." Mr. Leland Stanford turned to his wife and said, "Mama, we can do it." It was a good evening of interesting interchange. John Connolly told the story about him and Lyndon as young naval officers in San Francisco about to set out on some unknown destination into the South Pacific, going into a little shop owned by Japanese, who knew that within a week's time he would be in a concentration camp, and who therefore naturally had some bargains, and buying for us, for Nellie and me, some lovely things. I still have and cherish my pearls. And then he went on to say how, when he and Nellie were out there, just before Christmas, they went into the same shop, found exactly the same proprietor. He remembered John's face. He was delighted to see him. He told him that he knew the other man had become president of the United States and he'd followed his career with so much interest. And about that time, his wife punched him and said, "But you don't know who this young officer is now." The man did not, and was delighted to discover that the other young man of 23 years ago is now the governor of Texas. But Pearson topped it when he told that he had only visited a London tailor twice in his life. The first time was in 1917, when as a young lieutenant, which he pronounced lieutenant, he had bought a suit, a military uniform, from a London shop. And then he went back into the same shop in 1964. The man who made it was still there. What's more, he opened his books, turned back his records to the very day in 1917, told him his measurements and how much he'd paid for his uniform. Both proprietor and tailor were still on the job. That speaks something of England, something that the world has come to expect of it, rather. It was an early-to-bed evening, but one of the most delightful state dinners I can remember, and apparently satisfactory from Rusk and MacGeorge Bundy's standpoint.